Welcome to episode 2 of The Short Way Home. I'm your host, Mike Chin. This podcast is released in conjunction with my new book, The Long Way Home, from Cowboy Jamboree Press. Cowboy Jamboree Press is also the exclusive home, as of now, for Sheldon Lee Compton's new fiction. That includes his book from last year, Dysphoria, and his upcoming title, Sway. Visit them online at cowboyjamboreemagazine.com. Thank you to Adam Van Winkle, the founder and general editor for Cowboy Jamboree Press, not only for his collaboration on bringing this book into the world, but also for the art for the book cover, as well as this podcast's artwork. Okay, this episode, the focus is going to be on Bret the Hitman Hart versus the British Bulldog Davey Boy Smith. This match was the main event of SummerSlam 1992, went down on August 29th of that year. It happened in Wembley Stadium in London with a reported attendance of 80,355. And it's certainly an unusual match. It was the rare occurrence of the Intercontinental Championship main eventing the show. I know that happened at least one other time in history, where it was Seth Rollins against Dolph Ziggler in the past, whatever that was. Was that 2018, 2019? Regardless, it's an unusual occurrence. Occasionally that title might have been on the line if there were multiple titles involved. But this was a rare case, especially in that era. I'm fairly certain that's the first time ever for a pay-per-view event that the Intercontinental Championship, kind of the secondary title to the world title, for those who don't really follow wrestling as much. Though, why are you listening to this podcast? Just kidding. You're welcome here. But regardless, it's rare for that title to be featured in that high profile of a spot. But this event did go down in front of a British crowd. There's an argument there for, the British Bulldog Davey Boy Smith kind of getting his big featured match, and that just made sense to feature him on last. And also there's a very real argument that nothing was going to follow this match. As in, it would be really difficult for any other two performers or combination of tag teams or whatnot to put on a match that would compare in quality or crowd reaction to what we'd seen here. There's a lot of ways in which this match feels like sort of the opposite of Hogan versus Andre from WrestleMania 3 that we talked about on the first episode of this show. It's a match that became legend for how good it was in a time when WWE wasn't necessarily known for a lot of great matches. It's pretty technical. It's pretty fast-paced. It features a lot of compelling spots. It's something you can watch in a vacuum and still, I think, enjoy if you enjoy professional wrestling on any level. And it ends with, in my mind, still one of the great finishes to a match. What Bret Hart is referred to as the Leo Burke finish, and I borrowed that title for my original chapbook and an essay that references. But where basically Bret goes for a sunset flip, and Bulldog sits down on him and hooks his legs and holds him down for the pin. On one hand, overpowering him, it just kind of comes down to the fact that these guys are so evenly matched. It makes some sense that the stronger, heavier of the two guys would be able to win a wrestling match. But secondarily, also, there's a sense that, at least for that moment, Davey Boy Smith out-wrestles him, which is no small feat against Bret, who was kind of coming into his own as a great technical wrestler. Certainly, he'd been there for quite some time in reality. But in terms of his character, in terms of the stories WWE was telling, that was really coming into sharp focus in that era. So this match, it stood out for being great. And objectively and in a vacuum, I think it does hold up in that way. But the interesting thing about watching this match from a 2020 perspective is, while it's still great, and it still has, sentimental and kind of nostalgic value for someone, for my generation who, watched it, more or less when it happened, I would also make the argument that if we're going to be really objective about it, pretty much every NXT TakeOver show has a match about as good as this. If we just kind of watch it in a vacuum, without the surrounding storyline, without any sentimental value attached to, Bret Hart or Davey Boy Smith. And it's a funny thing because on one hand, you could very readily say, well, that's a great thing if you get to have matches like that, 4 or 5 times a year. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. You should enjoy that. But, you know, one question it raised for me as I was reflecting on this match and thinking about, you know, what I was going to talk about on this episode of the show was something that it might be an unpopular opinion to even suggest. I'm not even saying I necessarily agree with this opinion, but the question of, do we have too many good matches now? And, you know, again, it feels like that's kind of a silly question to ask, but, in a situation where so many matches are great, is it possible for anything to really stand out anymore? Or does it have to be so exceptional that we start to dismiss, you know, what are perfectly good matches, even though just because they're not great outings? As an example of that, a really recent one I'll take from the Elimination Chamber 2020 show, we have a 3-on-1 handicap match with the heels Sami Zayn, Shinsuke Nakamura, and Cesaro all teaming up against Braun Strowman. And a lot of people panned this match and don't think it was very good. And they kind of panned the usage of Braun Strowman, who could, you know, certainly be a main event guy. And if we're going to cut deeper, you know, basically anyone on the heel team could in and of themselves be a much better featured heel in their own right. But, you know, when we actually watch this match, I would go so far as to say it's technically very good. One of the best Braun Strowman matches for sure, which probably shouldn't be a surprise because, you know, Zayn, Nakamura, Cesaro are all very good performers in their own right. So the idea of them all working together would come to some creative spots and do some things that would make sense to kind of set them up as heels to be able to defeat this, you know, much larger opponent. So, a match like that, I'm not going to say it's anywhere near as good as Bret Hart versus Davey Boy Smith at SummerSlam 92. But I will suggest that, if that's the standard we're going to hold every match to, is it has to be of that caliber of technical quality, of work rate, of pacing. Well, that's just kind of a ridiculous standard. So, we take this other Intercontinental Championship match from whatever it is, is that 28 years later? And we kind of are inclined to dismiss it so quickly. I don't think that's entirely fair. I think just because it's not a very good match, it's still a solid match, and it still showcases what the guys can do. I think the finishing spot, where Zayn and Nakamura pick up Strowman in suplex formation, and Cesaro and Nakamura lets him up like that, and then Zayn delivers the Huluva kick. That's fun. That's creative. That's physically impressive. Anyway, we're not really talking about that match here. I'm supposed to be focusing on Bulldog versus Bret, but nonetheless, it's an interesting question, I think, of, you know, again, can there be too much of a good thing to the point where it takes away from those things that don't quite measure up to that standard? Of course, all that being said, you know, nothing exists in a vacuum. Everything exists within its, you know, context that it happens. And that's where, you know, obviously, Bret Hart versus Davey Boy Smith was way ahead of its time. And in many ways, a signal of some of what was to come in mainstream professional wrestling. It also had a pretty compelling story at hand there. So we had Bret Hart and Davey Boy Smith were real life brothers-in-law. Davey Boy Smith was married to Bret Hart's sister, Diana, and WWE went ahead and leaned right into that, which I think was a very shrewd move at that time to build kind of a unique dynamic for this thing. Both guys were face characters. They were both good guys. And it could have worked probably just as a sporting contest between two guys just to see who is the better man and all that jazz. But I think adding that more personal dimension to it, almost a sibling rivalry kind of feel to it, get more to the point, this one guy, being his brother and knowing that this other guy is sleeping with his sister, even in the limits of a marriage, I think that does set up some level of natural kind of conflict, especially between two guys who've, been wrestling for this long. There's also the historical context of this match, and I would argue it's pivotal in terms of Bret Hart's advancement as a wrestler. For one thing, it's a carry job. At least if you buy into Hart's own account of it, he wrote about it in his memoir, which, again, for anyone who likes wrestling, I think it's a absolutely outstanding book, Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling, where he talks about he had kind of plotted out the match and, worked with Bulldog on it. And then Bulldog shows up for the event and says, "I forgot it all." And he's been, I don't remember the specifics, but, you know, a suggestion that he's been among his countrymen and kind of just, you know, having fun with old friends and not really thinking about wrestling, maybe using some substances. And I'm not sure about that component, so I don't want to lay down, you know, false accusations. But nonetheless, you know, shows up not really in a proper mental state to, you know, perform. And Hart just kind of feeds the match to him and kind of tells him what to do at every stage and that there are a couple slip-ups. And if you go back and watch this stuff, you can actually see what Hart's talking about. For example, when he, you know, jumps over the top rope and Smith's not really in position to catch him, and Hart's got to kind of improvise around that. And at the end of the match afterwards, Wayne Hart says that, you know, he doesn't go to Bulldog at first. Bulldog's supposed to go to him and kind of, you know, get him up there and give him a handshake and, you know, show they're mending fences, but he forgets the spot. So little things like that, but, you know, Hart kind of, you know, making this match what it was, even if, you know, Hart's exaggerating and, you know, David Boy Smith wasn't in such bad shape, and did contribute more, still, you know, if we even take them both as, you know, equals in that regard, there's no denying that Hart's the stronger overall performer in this thing and doing the more technically impressive things. And this match is really, it's the last stop on the way for Bret Hart to become a main event guy. It was his first, you know, pay-per-view one-on-one match. He loses a title, but in many ways that's freeing him up, because that fall then he goes on to win the world title. So the next time WWE has a pay-per-view at Survivor Series, he walks into that as the world champion. And so this is largely a step in that direction. This is also both of these guys, I would argue, right around their physical peaks, which is interesting because, you know, we can separate, you know, physical peak from, you know, peak of performance, as in, you know, has a lot of experience and technical know-how and, you know, is kind of a better performer for all that, as opposed to just being, you know, their physical, you know, strongest, most athletic, so on and so forth. You know, and by basis of comparison, for example, like Stone Cold Steve Austin, right? This guy, you know, with the possible exception of Hulk Hogan, as, you know, the biggest star in the wrestling world, you know, for a period of years there. But he was already pretty broken down by the time he got there, and it's part of why his career ultimately wasn't that long by you know, wrestling standards, especially by today's wrestling standards. You know, got hurt, you know, a lot over the years, had a lot of wear and tear in his body, and specifically neck issues, just because when he was entering his peak as a star, as opposed to, you know, his physical peak. But, you know, for both, you know, Davey Boy Smith and Bret Hart, you know, you can make a real argument that this was, you know, physically their peak, that, you know, Hart was kind of moving into his prime in terms of, you know, just being able to be a ring general and kind of run the show, you know, and he'd be a bona fide main event guy moving on from this. So there's no argument that he ends up being a bigger star after this point. You know, he goes on to headline three WrestleManias, depending on, you know, how you define, you know, main eventing a WrestleMania. But he closes out at least two of them. And the one that's kind of, you know, has some controversy to it, WrestleMania 9, because technically another match happens after Hart loses the world title to Yokozuna, but that's a, you know, kind of impromptu, you know, sub-1-minute match, so it's hard to call that the main event. But in any event, you know, does go on to bigger things. For Smith, even though he would go on to work world title matches, they'd be at lesser pay-per-views. You know, never one of the, you know, original Big Four, Big Five, and never in front of a crowd, you know, nearly this size or nearly this kind of invested in his work. So it's hard to say that he doesn't really peak here. This might be, you know, the top moment of his career. So overall, it's one of my favorite matches. You know, hit me at a time as a fan when, you know, wrestling was just kind of exiting that first peak from my childhood. It was original Hulkamania years. This is the first WWE, you know, proper pay-per-view, or what would go on to be a traditional pay-per-view that doesn't include Hulk Hogan in any capacity at all. You know, and so the brand is kind of struggling a little bit here to kind of, you know, redefine its identity. You know, I just remember kind of being blown away by the quality of this match, and, you know, and sort of, I think didn't even notice the kind of changing of the guard, in part because the new guard was so impressive in terms of the physical show that they were able to put on, and that style of storytelling, which was very different from, you know, what we'd seen in the previous generation. But okay, so from here on, I'm going to read you again a piece from the book, The Long Way Home. So I'm going to read a short piece. It's from the first section, the autopsy and everything after part of the book. It's the second piece overall in the book. This one was originally published in Passages North. It also appeared just in the standalone chapbook, Autopsy and Everything After, as well as in Best Microfictions 2019 as an anthology there. It's a very short one, so it's called Training. We signed up on the hope of gold-plated, leather-strap championship belts. The wonder of children, the lust from women who doted over biceps. All we were promised were aching bodies and misery. We hoped we would be good, naturals from day one. We hoped to learn how to make pulled punches, inverted top rope hurricanranas, and cross-faced chicken wings look devastating without anyone getting hurt. The first lesson promised something to the contrary, promised everyone would get hurt. He stretched us, hammerlocks and full Nelsons and neck cranks, then the chokes, one by one putting us to sleep. We didn't sleep much. Four-door room, two bare mattresses that were stained with blood, that smelled like feet, that they were all too small for two men's bodies. So half of us slept on the floor, the losers of arm wrestling matches and rock, paper, scissors contests. Some quit. We bruised and bled and scarred and got staph infections. A few of us cried, but not as many as you would have were the penalty not an extra hour of training, and during Romero specials, wind sprints until we hurled, Hindu squats until our piss ran red. We turned ankles and dislocated shoulders and kept on until we had fractures, kept on until we hurt permanently. Some quit. We learned to give and receive fireballs, Memphis style. Fireballs that singed our eyebrows and left rippling wounds over our eyelids. Some quit. We dove, in the ring, body to body, then off the top rope to the floor. Won't we die? Only a few of us thought to ask. To be one of us, the trainer said, you have to give up your life. So did we quit now? We who carried on, we few, we hoped we might be legends. We were promised nothing. Okay, so that was Training. Thank you for listening. The Long Way Home is available from Cowboy Jamboree Press, distributed through Amazon. You can follow me on Twitter @MikeTChin or visit MikeTChin.com for more details.